noticed a tall, stunning Columbus blonde, beautiful enough to be Miss Georgia, staring at me with bedroom eyes from across the room. I started feeling mighty warm, and no sooner had old Jimmy gone home to little Barbara than I found myself with the blonde in the back of a Cadillac Eldorado in Chad's parking lot. Don't know what to say, officer. It's called spontaneous combustion or something. Miss Georgia was something else. Mrs. Georgia, to be exact, two times over. Her first husband had been killed in 1944. Now she was married to one of his West Point classmates. The Army, and particularly the Academy, is a very closed society. It takes care of its own. Her present husband, a major, was now off fighting communists in Korea. So Mrs. G was a lovely, lonely lady who wanted someone to fill the void, a live-in mate for the duration. I liked her, but I didn't like the role. At first it was great. Home-cooked meals, drinks by the pool, solitude, and warm magnolia nights on her lovely property in the country. But it didn't take long before I felt like my old buddies in their ticky-tacky government-issued wood-framed cottages who envied me and my freedom. Mrs. G was a good woman, but I was getting kind of bored. I missed kicking around with my friends, and even worse, I felt like a real shit, screwing this nice lady while her husband was over there fighting. I'd been assigned to Camp Roberts after my course ended. Soon Mrs. G started talking about moving to Paso Robles with me. She said she'd just wait for her husband there. I stopped feeling bored. Now scared seemed more appropriate. First I tried to avoid her, but that was impossible. She had a copy of the class's weekly training schedule, which listed what, where, and when for my every move throughout the day. I'd even find her waiting with the dutiful army brides at the company area when buses brought us back from distant classes. Next, I tried hiding from her. I stopped answering the phone messages she left with the CQ. I'd never been one who liked to give the bad news to ladies. The way I finally escaped was by telling her I'd busted the course and had to leave immediately for Camp Roberts. A friend scratched my name off the CQ's roster and annotated it "Returned to Unit," and I stashed my yellow convertible in a nearby pine forest, next to a bright red Kaiser with 8 slugs through its ass, having unwittingly joined at least one of my classmates as a desperate fugitive who knew he'd done nothing particularly wrong except make a lonely army wife's nights a little shorter. The hide-and-seek with Mrs. Georgia was probably the final straw. I hadn't liked anything about my stateside tour. The training was not only bad, it was depressing. I was uncomfortable in the peacetime role, a sow's ear that didn't especially want to be transformed into a silk purse, and I was afraid to go to West Point. I was never one to joust at windmills. I never took on a job I knew I couldn't win, and I wouldn't win in those hallowed halls. I probably had a post-combat hangover, too. Nothing here felt real. I read the papers every day. Across the ocean in Korea was where it was happening. The peace talks had come to naught. The war was going hot and heavy. Our units under 8th Army C.G. Van Fleet seemed to be on the move, and I wanted to be there, too. My friends, especially the World War II vets, tried like older brothers to talk me out of volunteering for a second tour. Do as I say, not as I've done, I thought. I wrote Crispino to tell him to meet me at the Wolfhounds. I submitted my paperwork to AG. The young clerk who processed my application said I'd have to attend a Korea pre-combat orientation course. I didn't even argue. There seemed little point in telling this pink-cheeked kid I'd been down the road before. The 4-month company-grade course was drawing to a close. Out of a class of 243, there were 180 students left, none any the wiser about our profession. I graduated 108th. Not brilliant, just crammed to the gills with trust knowledge gained in a period of history just peaceable enough to have time for that mass of less important details. Those of us who made it could separate ourselves from the failures only by good memories and an ability or willingness to regurgitate on command for an exam. None of us had learned to think. It was not part of the required curriculum. The instructor in our last class was a rugged infantry lieutenant colonel of weathered face, boxer's build, and starched neat khaki uniform. He wore a polished blue helmet liner with the white instructor's band. He wore combat medals, too, from two wars. He'd done well. He was the kind of stud warriors immediately respect. His subject was the rifle company in the defense in Korea, and he gave us an amazing example of a company that had held a hill against incredible odds. The Chinese had thrown thousands of men against it, but the company held like a rock. The unit was cut off from its battalion, isolated deep in enemy territory. Battered and bruised, it held on. And when ammo and food ran out, the troopers lived off the land and used captured weapons. They built a barrier wall of tree branches, like the men at Valley Forge. The Chinamen came and the Chinamen went, and the valiant unit did not give an inch until finally a U.S. tank force broke through and extricated it. It really was an extraordinary example, and the colonel left no doubt that only the rare skill, strong leadership, and tremendous courage of the company commander had made it all possible. "I am proud to tell you," he went on, "that this unit was from my battalion. Its skipper, who has been recommended for the Medal of Honor, is one of your classmates." We all looked around, applauding, wondering who among us had so ably worn Superman's cape. "Lieutenant Doug Anderson," said the colonel. "Will you please stand up?" There was a long pause. Then our Air Force class leader stood up at rigid attention. "Sir," he shouted, "Lieutenant Anderson was dismissed from this class 3 weeks ago for academic deficiency." And that just about said it all. 9. Don't look back. When First Lieutenant Hackworth reported to me at the north rim of the Punch Bowl late one October afternoon in 1952, I remember returning his casual but soldierly salute with the immediate thought of, what a wonderful, cheerful grin. Later I would call him the Happy Warrior. He was that. We spent one or two days and nights together. For me, it was a stimulating, interesting professional time, and from this brief episode I came to think of Hack as one of the infantry officers who epitomized the best in combat leadership. His background was rough, and his education incomplete, but to my mind, he brought the skills, attitude, and courage to the American battle effort that West Point tried to indoctrinate in her graduates. 33 more years of experience have not changed my view. Colonel Joseph B. Love, United States Army, retired. Company Commander, G Company, 5th Infantry, Regimental Combat Team, Korea, 1952. We called him Hack. He was one of the boys. We did respect his rank, though, and everybody respected him, because he'd been around and he was good, and he kept us alive. Uno Rentmeister, Squad Leader, F Company, 223rd Infantry, Korea, 1952-53. When I left Korea in early 52, the 8th Army had been dug in for 6 months. As a raider, I'd been spared life in the trenches, so despite the glimpses I'd had of this reality during raider operations, in my mind's eye I still saw the lean, mean, mobile army of the first year of the war, racing up and down the peninsula, hardly ever spending two nights in the same place, getting our asses kicked and reeling in defeat, or kicking ass and driving the enemy back in resounding victory. From the moment I made my decision to return to the front, I'd really looked forward to getting back to that sort of fighting. As a result, I was almost totally unprepared for what I found when I got there. My second tour would prove to be a different war. Upon arrival in Pusan, I was sent marching not to my beloved Wolfhounds, but to the former 40th California National Guard Division. It was a heartbreak of the first order. The 40th had been federalized in September 50, but sent to Japan to train. It didn't get to Korea for another 2 years. Its members had not seen any combat other than patrol actions and a few company-sized operations, and all of these had only reinforced the unit's reputation as a sorry, undisciplined, ineffective fighting force. Its nickname, the California Crybaby Division, spoke for itself. I just couldn't see myself growing old and telling my children that during the war I'd been a member of such a candy-assed organization. If the truth be known, I didn't intend to stay there even one day. The CEO at the division's replacement company accepted every insult I could dish out about his unit. He calmly explained the guard was being phased out and the new CG had asked that every available stud, airborne ranger warrior types, be assigned to the 40th to give it some muscle. But I didn't want to hear about it. As far as I was concerned, I'd made a contract to return to the Wolfhounds when I volunteered, and I'd been betrayed. I railed my way up the chain of command until the AG received instructions to take me to the Chief of Staff's office at the Division Forward Command Post. To my great surprise, I was impressed with what I saw when we got there. The Division CP was Shades of Trieste. Everyone and everything dressed right and stood tall. The place actually had an airborne feel. The sparkling clean jeeps were painted that blue-black airborne color. The perfectly pressed and polished division security platoon wore black lacquered steel pots. It was strictly military and looked more like an 82nd Airborne unit than the 40th Crybaby Boys. The AG got the first nice words out of me since we'd met. He took the opportunity to tell me the airborne feel was no coincidence, that the CG, Major General Joseph P. Cleland, had come from the 82nd and had brought a number of his airborne people with him. And, the AG added, it was his impression that General Van Fleet had asked for Cleland by name to convert the 40th to a regular division. This should have been enough for me, but it wasn't. I could be very stubborn when I wanted to, and to my mind, if God himself had been CG of this unit, I still would have refused to wear the 40th patch. I told Colonel Dillander, the paratrooper chief of staff, just this, and demanded that I be sent to the Lightning Division. No sooner were these words out of my mouth than a small, neat figure with snow-white hair and mustache appeared before me. "Glad you're here, Lieutenant Hackworth. Come inside, would you? I want to have a few words with you." I followed him into his office. He guided me to a chair. "Now, why is it you don't want to belong to my outfit?" he asked. The voice was cool and quiet, the complexion smooth and rosy against the shock of white hair, kind of like Santa Claus. There was a magic twinkle in his eyes, brighter even than the two stars on each of his lapels. Major General Joe Cleland, the man who was to become my unsolicited patron, drew up a chair beside me. He listened intently as I told him I was a 27th man, a wolfhound, and that I'd come back to Korea to fight, not to play nursemaid to a bunch of NG third-string weekend warriors. Cleland smiled. He knew the wolfhounds, and he knew what I was talking about. "But you have to remember," he told me, "there are no bad outfits, only bad officers." He said he was now getting his pick of the best, and that the 40th would be exactly what he and his collection of warrior leaders made of it. "I could go back to the wolfhounds," he continued, those merry eyes dancing, "but only if I wanted to be the second best unit in Korea." Cleland was persuasive, confident, but not manipulative. I knew in my gut he was very much a soldier, and a soldier's soldier at that. So he'd won me hands down even before he said that if I stayed he could do more for me than any other CG in the country. "I'm going to give you a rifle company, Lieutenant, and see you get a damn good chance to fight it." It was the biggest surprise of my 21 years. I spent the night at Division CP. At dawn, I awoke to the sounds of running and the count of calisthenics. I looked out of the tent to see a superbly fit General Cleland double-timing down the road with members of his staff. Probably half of this bunch were still guard types, fat, out of shape, wheezing with every step. But Joe Cleland, 50 years old if a day, led the pack, shaping up the 40th Division from the top by personal example. The drive from Division to the 223rd Regimental HQ gave me the opportunity to see exactly how far Blitzkrieg had moved to Sitzkrieg in this war. Everything seemed to be poured in concrete. Artie was dug in to stay. At regiment itself, there were volleyball courts, snack bars, EM and officers' clubs, and officers' messes but a maitre d' away from the Ritz. It was not just the permanency that struck me, but the attendant luxury. All the goodies were there. Nightly movies, well-stocked PXs, starched fatigues, even an outdoor amphitheater with the stage and row beyond row of green sandbag seats. And all this was within earshot of artillery crashing down on the poor bastards in the trenches. Gibraltar, the Rock, home of the 223rd, said the sign. Complacency under canvas, it might have read. I was shocked and actually frightened by this living, breathing example of an army in the defense. Had it been this bad during the Raider days? Had I misread the newspapers back at Benning, or read more into them because I so badly wanted to come back? The army I saw now obviously had no intention of attacking, and without that, it had no hope of winning. The HQ was an airborne all-the-way mini-replica of the 40th Division CP, but from the moment I entered the CP area, I felt that none of it was quite real. The adjutant, Major Doak, greeted me as if I were his replacement rather than a pimply-faced lieutenant. "The colonel is waiting to meet you at his quarters," he gushed. I had a chance to have a good look at my new regimental CO while he glanced over my service record. Colonel Lewis Truman was smooth, exceptionally handsome, immaculately dressed in tailored fatigues and infantry blue scarf. Manicured from the top of his head to his buffed and clipped fingernails, he had the theatrical presence of Douglas Fairbanks, or maybe that other Douglas, MacArthur. When we'd met moments before, he hadn't walked up to greet me. He glided. He hadn't talked. He purred. "Yes, Lieutenant, the old man rang me, gave you the highest recommendation. He wants you to have a rifle company." He was still purring as he made small talk over my record. "A lot of combat. 4 Purple Hearts. Excellent background." Then came the hook. "You've known the general before?" I should have said he was my father and I his bastard son. Cleland must have given me one hell of an introduction. Now this good politician before me, it was all becoming clear, wanted to know how deep the connection was. How it might affect him, I couldn't imagine. The story about Truman was that he was the president's nephew, and a guy couldn't get much more clout than that. The colonel then briefed me on the regiment. It was in reserve, and, like the rest of the division, phasing out the guard and assimilating new replacements. The unit had the numbers, but not the experience. It was suffering from an acute shortage of tried-and-true NCOs and qualified junior officers. At company level, most COs had less than 2 years service, platoon leaders less than 1. That's why Cleland was trying like hell to get seasoned people and why, explained Truman, "we're so glad to have you aboard." So glad to have you aboard. I looked around for the gangplank so I could jump ship. About this time, Major Arthur Hyman, the regimental operations officer, fresh out of the 82nd II, glided in. Maybe he took lessons from Truman. "Colonel," he said, "hate to bother you, but this is hot." That's how they talked, cliché after cliché, with a kind of manufactured urgency. Soon Hyman glided out, the plans for the next morning's hot training exercise burning holes through his hands. Enter Adjutant Doak, who had a hurried whisper with the colonel before exiting stage right. Truman turned back to me with sympathetic, doleful eyes. "Lieutenant, there is no rifle company command position available in the regiment, but what we can do is assign you to the 1st Battalion as CO of D Company." Heavy weapons, I thought. Great. The minute I walk out of this room, I'm going back to division and get on my pony for the wolfhounds. But Truman read my thoughts. "You understand, Lieutenant, this is just a stopgap position. You will get the 1st rifle company that opens up in the regiment. In the meantime, I think the experience will be good for you. I notice you've only had rifle company experience. This will round out your career, so to speak." So to speak. As it happened, Truman was right. The heavy weapons experience was good for me. Through it, I learned the importance of the infantry's organic supporting arms, knowledge which would prove invaluable to me in my subsequent higher-level infantry commands. Lieutenant Colonel John C. Young, down at 1st Bat, was a poor imitation of Colonel Truman. He wore the same tailored fatigues, the same infantry scarf, but everything was a bit wrinkled, and nothing seemed to fit quite right. Young explained that the battalion was training hard and would go online in about 5 weeks. As he gave me a rundown on Company D's strengths and shortcomings, I was struck with the strongest feeling that this CO didn't know what he was talking about. Like a professor of mechanical engineering who knows the language but has never seen a motor or had grease on his hands, that's how this guy was with the jargon of infantry. Or so it appeared to me. I gave myself a good talking to as I left his office. After all, Young was a light colonel of infantry. He was probably very qualified to run this outfit. Maybe I was just used to rough cobs skippering battalions. Young was just different, as Truman was so different from Sloan. And maybe it was my own anxiety about taking over a company. I'd never expected such an opportunity. I hadn't thought I had enough experience. Now it was obvious, at least in a comparative sense, that I did. But what a place to do it in. All green guys in an all-green regiment. No famous heritage like the Wolfhounds to build a spree upon, when a spree was probably the only win-lose factor left in this war. My new charges, whatever unit I ended up with, would probably be most un-raider-like. They'd have read the papers. Surely they'd know the peace talks were ongoing, even at a snail's pace, and all would be waiting for the breakthrough, none wanting to be the last casualty in a no-win war. It was a hell of a big leadership problem. How would I motivate these guys, fire them up for the big game, when all they'd want to do would be hide in their bunkers and hope they'd make it until it was time to go home? As it turned out, I had far fewer problems with my men than I did with Colonel Young. I lasted in his command just over a month. Our first confrontation was over what Young considered my unorthodox supply procedures. Ammunition was rationed for training. But when my supply sergeant found a rock supply depot that would swap us ammo for sea rations, the raider in me logically told me to go for it. Sure, it was irregular. As a matter of fact, it was totally illegal. The rocks would no doubt sell the seas on the black market. But I didn't care. My job was to knock these troops. Only about 50% were NG now, but that was plenty to keep the outfit bopping along more like a fraternity than a military unit, into shape with heavy-duty hands-on training. And if I could do just one thing, it would be to make damn sure that when I went on to Truman's promised rifle company, these guys in the rear would be proficient enough not to clobber us with inaccurate but no less lethal fire. Young locked my heels together for not going by the book. "You have to go through regular supply channels, Lieutenant." "You can't fire requisitions, Colonel," I replied. Our second confrontation was about my unorthodox troop leading procedures. Having taken just one look at the sorry condition of D Company, I'd implemented a dawn-to-midnight training schedule. The boys didn't know what had hit them, but whatever it was, they were none too pleased. I also established an open-door policy, a period every day when troops could see me without going through the chain of command. My first visitor was a young NG sergeant. "Why don't you just cut out all this training shit?" he demanded. "Most of us are going home, and then out of the blue you come in like a madman and give us all this extra work. We don't like it, and we're not buying it." I told him he didn't have to buy it, that I was giving it away free of charge. I reminded him he was in a regular army unit now, and if he didn't like that, I'd extend his sweet ass in Korea for 6 months by tossing him into the slammer for insubordination. The kid didn't care. He charged right back, telling me he was going to see some NG major up at division. "I'll tell him what you've been doing here and he'll fire you." I could not believe my ears. And why, I asked, would he fire me? "He works for my father. He's a supervisor in Dad's company in California." I told him I didn't give a damn what his father did for a living. He had nothing to do with this outfit. Nor did I take orders from majors who were not in my chain of command. And furthermore, I wound up, if the California National Guard sergeant opened his mouth one more time, I'd fill it up with my good old California regular army fist. The trooper got the message, and the word got out to his NG buddies. Day by day, some rotated home. The new replacements and those who remained started to snap into shape and play by the rules. But in the meantime, word got back to Young that I'd threatened this kid. It was a small thing that he made a big drama. He did not stop for a moment to see that the unit was coming together, that maybe these guys could be made ready in the few weeks remaining until they went online. I gave up on the CO completely. It was just too frustrating. Fortunately, Colonel Young had a brilliant S3 by the name of Captain Joe McDonough, who, the more I watched, I could see actually ran the battalion on the quiet. McDonough, who would go on to make 2 stars, was a West Pointer, a jumper from the 82nd. "What is it with this battalion?" I'd asked myself when I first walked into his S3 tent and saw a sign over his desk in Latin. When he'd translated it for me, "Don't let the bastards wear you down," it said, I breathed a sigh of relief. It was the first down-to-earth thing I'd heard since I'd left General Cleland. I felt even better when Captain Mack confirmed my initial feelings about Young. It turned out the battalion CO was a finance officer who'd branch transferred to infantry. So he was just a brilliant guy with stars in his eyes. He had little hands-on experience to back himself up. Worse, though, was that he was not alone in his inexperience. At this point in time, Joe McDonough was the only officer in the battalion who'd commanded a rifle company in combat. Still, the unit was shaping up, not just in terms of proficiency, but in terms of spirit. And this was due to the ever-present Joe Cleland. He came to be known as the Great White Father, whom you might find running along with your company in the wee hours of the morning or suddenly standing behind you, listening in as you worked through a tactical problem. His style and techniques mirrored Ridgway's 10 years earlier, when the latter ramrodded the 82nd into airborne perfection. No one ever knew when Cleland would appear, so everyone was always on the stick. His energy seeped through the whole division. Within weeks, the organization became worthy of the bright yellow sunburst on the 40th's blue shoulder patch. No longer the California crybabies. Through Cleland's personal example, we were well on our way to becoming, indeed as well as name, the Fireball Division. Finally, First Bat was tasked to relieve another unit on a line. I was pretty confident that my D Company charges wouldn't do too much damage on the battlefield except where it counted, and the rifle company commanders and I went forward a few days early to plan and recon the relief. As the heavy weapons CO, I was responsible for the battalion fire plan. When I first got this job, I'd scrounged a copy of the Heavy Weapons Field Manual and begun reading up, almost wishing I paid more attention at Benning when we'd discussed the functioning of a heavy weapons company. But I hadn't given it any thought at the time. I saw myself as a frontline infantryman. Heavy weapons had seemed like rear echelon shit. To my mind, they still were, but if I had to be a rear echelon commando, I was determined to be the best rear echelon commando and had studied long and hard, at night and on the job, to this end. Now on the line, my task was first to establish interlocking bands of grazing fire across the battalion front, then to cover dead spots with indirect fire starting with D Company's mortars, and finally to deploy the principally anti-tank recoilless rifles to cover tank and infantry approaches. I walked along the front, selecting my sights and alerting the rifle company COs so they could plan to shift their own weapons as necessary. Heavy weapons had priority of sights, in that the interlocking bands of fire had to tie in with the battalions on either side, as part of a red-proof line that stretched the whole way across Korea. All went well until one of the company COs refused to shift a BAR to make way for a heavy machine gun section. We got into an argument, which heated up, a la Sergeant Reeves back in G Company, to the point where we were ready to duke it out. Reason came to my aid at the last moment. The CO had a chip on his shoulder the size of a mortar tube. He was a short guy with the runt complex, and I decided to let the battalion commander intervene. After I finished my deployment plan, I left the line and headed back to Colonel Young. I told him the story and requested he talk to the CO. Young rubbed his hands together like the worried old bookkeeper he was and said, "It's Charlie's area. He knows what's best." "Colonel, we're talking about an integrated fire plan right out of FM7-15. I took the field manual out of my jacket and thumped it on his desk. "It's quite pointless to argue, Lieutenant." "Look, I will read from the book," I replied, and read the thing, chapter and verse. I slammed the field manual down again. So it has no goddamned bearing on whose area it's in. Heavy weapons has priority of sights. Lieutenant, I suggest you not use profanity in my presence. That was the absolute limit. I blew up. Colonel, you can take this battalion and stuff it right up your ass. After 40 days in this limp dick outfit, I'm convinced you could not run a good Boy Scout troop. With that, I saluted, whirled around, and stormed out. It had all to do with a deep moral feeling on my part. The book was the book. You could play with it, make it better based on your own experience, but on basic tactical matters, it held proven principles for success that had evolved from a lot of wars over a lot of years. I should have realized Colonel Finance wouldn't know this. He probably didn't know an M1 from an adding machine. On the other hand, maybe I had realized it, and I'd just been looking for a final shootout. But I think what pissed me off even more was that the guy did not have the guts to stand tall during a fight between two subordinates. I decided I was right, morally right, and army right, but that Truman would not know this. The last thing I needed now was to blow my top at the regimental CO, too. I was already worried about what I'd said to Young. Not that it wasn't true, but it was just not the way one addressed his CO. I went straight to General Cleland and told him what happened. He agreed with me on the tactical end of things. As for my tact, he was less impressed. In fact, he chewed my ass royally. With much fire in his voice, he said I needed to learn patience, respect for my superiors, and most important, control over my temper. I agreed down the line, but told him it was hard. I've learned in 1950 that war was a serious game. People died in it. But guys like Young didn't seem to know this, and it seemed that the Youngs were in charge wherever I looked. Sometimes, Hackworth, the general replied, it's better to be like the three monkeys. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. The army is changing. You must do the best you can, even while you're changing with it. Before I left, he called Truman. A rifle company had miraculously opened up in second bat. Cleland assured me that the old airborne CO Bill Locke was my kind of soldier. You'll be on the line in a couple of days, son, he concluded as he walked me to the door. Good luck. Take care of yourself. And watch that temper. I returned to Company D, packed my gear, and split with no regrets. To my great relief, there was no repercussions from my blow-up at Colonel Young, or so I thought. His last laugh came long after he'd been killed in Korea on the reverse slope of A Company's sector. He'd taken the opportunity to render an officer efficiency report on me, a form I'd never paid much mind to in Easy or the Raiders, for my short tenure in his command. The words impetuous and immature on that ER, an accurate assessment, I had to admit, were to sting my ass in a big way for almost a decade to come. I arrived at the second bat CP, and for the first time really knew I'd soon be back on the line. Everyone was moving briskly, packing up and getting ready to go. A rush of adrenaline ran through me. Long dormant, that unfamiliar buzz which resonates in your gut all the time you're in combat, awoke with a start. I liked the feeling. I also liked this place. Precise, neat, military. Young's battalion had looked good too, but there it seemed the precision was all for show. A just-in-case exactness, as if to prevent God or at least General Cleland from suddenly swooping down and catching the outfit short. Here, the exactness was organic. It thrived on itself. No one seemed to be looking over his shoulder for higher command's approval. Dick Whedon, the battalion adjutant, told me the colonel was up front on a recon. I filled the time processing in and being briefed on battalion SOPs and the operational readiness of Fox Company, my new command. At one point, the battalion XO, Major Charles Brown, took me aside to tell me Colonel Locke was one mean hombre, the worst-tempered, toughest guy he'd ever worked for. Brown would know. He was a hard old warrior himself, wounded 3 times in World War II, and I began to wonder if maybe I should have stayed with Colonel Young. A bit later, Whedon said the old man was back and would meet me in the battalion mess. I went in. No colonel. A small, thin captain wearing Medical Service Corps insignia and a Korean Military Assistance Group KMAG patch walked in. As the mess was about to close, I decided not to wait any longer and ate with him. We made the usual small talk, and then he started asking me what I thought of the 40th Division, what I'd heard about 2nd Bat. Really strange questions that started my sixth sense screaming. Why would an overage in grade MSC KMAG captain give a damn about this division or this battalion? Maybe he and the colonel were pals. Hell, the guy was so old, maybe his only friend in the world was the colonel. So I answered his questions, but in a very guarded kind of way. About this time, Whedon came in. "Oh," he said, "I'm glad you found each other. Have you been introduced to the colonel, Lieutenant Hackworth?" Not only was this Colonel Locke mean, he was very, very sneaky. My new CO dismissed his trick with a shrug, saying he'd forgotten about his recon disguise. Like hell, I thought. The minute his disguise was dropped, he got down to business with the most colorful vocabulary I'd ever heard. The scuttlebutt was that Locke had been a mule skinner in the old horse calf. All that was certain was he did swear like one. Poor old George Washington must have been rolling in his grave. In July 1776, he'd issued an order to the Continental Army that swearing, that unmeaning and abominable custom, was forever banned. The order still stood in 1952. General Washington, of all people, should have known that one must never issue an order that cannot be enforced. Colonel Locke was old Army through and through. The word was he'd risen to top kick before the war. Then was battlefield commissioned while with Merrill's Marauders in Burma. Since 1945, he'd served with the 82nd as battalion CO and regimental XO. The man was mean as a snake, and looked like one, too, a rattler about to strike. He was thin, almost bald, with a long face and thin, tight lips he mashed together like Humphrey Bogart. He chewed tobacco, had a stain from it on his cheek, and his teeth were ground down like an old horse's. He also minced no words. He said the battalion was locked, cocked, and ready to go. We would go forward in the morning, coordinate with the outfit we were to relieve, stay 24 hours to get the lay of things, and return to our unit. From Locke's point of view, the terms of my own employment were simple. If I fucked up, I was out. Then, having made himself so succinctly and painfully clear, he rose to leave. His last unsmiling words, "Welcome to the 2nd Battalion." Whedon was pleased I'd gotten along so well with the colonel. Though it was news to me, now I understood the flawless condition of his unit. He ran it on pure fear. His men had no time to worry about surprise visits from Cleland. They had enough on their plates just watching out for their mule skinner CO. Fox Company had talent. Untried, but it was there. The platoon leaders were West Pointer, Class of 51, Joe Rice, ROTC grad Joe Stokes, and Boyd Guttery, an AG man doing his infantry stint. None had more than 12 months troop experience to bring to his platoon, yet instinctively I knew each was a good man. Eager and bright, in a few months, with lots of work, they'd be studs on the battlefield. As their fledgling company commander, though, my biggest concern was who was going to hold their hands through the worst of it. Normally, green lieutenants leaned on their old sergeants until the realities of combat caught up with their West Point OCS or ROTC book learning. The problem in Fox, and across the front, was that the U.S. Army had totally run out of NCOs. I had to put two corporals, Felbert Allison and OCS dropout Homer Smith, in platoon sergeant positions. These jobs were normally held by master sergeants, but even my top kick, Gregory, was only a staff sergeant whose complete infantry experience had been as a company clerk somewhere along the line. My saving grace in the unit was actually a PFC named Herschel Hudson, whom I assigned to round out the rifle platoon sergeant team. The HUD was a World War II platoon sergeant who'd re-enlisted for Korea. All in all, I had a good team, though it looked as if officer and NCO would be leaning on each other for the next little while. My own job was already shaping up to be not just commander, but chief instructor. I got the company together to give them my "I am your new CO" talk and set in motion a training program for the period I was on recon. In this respect, I did not feel daunted by the number of men, 200, I was now responsible for. The 2-day 40-hour crash course would concentrate on the same basics, battle drill, night defense procedures, field fortifications, and night relief, I'd taught and reinforced in my George squads of 11 and the Easy and Raider platoons of 40 to 50. I set up a relief rehearsal for the night I returned. With that, my recon party cut off our 40th Division patches, taped over the unit markings on our vehicles, and slipped up to the line. The first thing that struck me was that if a unit is a reflection of its commander, then 1st Lieutenant Joe Love, skipper of George Company, 5th Regimental Combat Team, the unit Fox would be relieving, was one of the best I'd seen in Korea. Love was a tall, handsome, southern charmer, West Point class of 50, and a total pro. In a no-win war where defeat and counting days until DROS, date-eligible return from overseas, had grabbed hold of the boys in the trenches in rolling tides as poisonous as mustard gas, Love ran a high-spirited, enthusiastic outfit. He did credit to the 5th RCT, one of the hard-fighting sister regiments of the Wolfhounds in the Hawaiian days. From range cards to hill weapons to fire plans, George Company was ready. The same, unfortunately, could not be said for the position. It wasn't Joe's fault. The worst of the place had been thrown up more than a year before when Siegfriedidas set in, and George Company hadn't been there long enough to make major fixes. The place was a maze and in bad repair. Bunkers were falling apart all over the hill, their sandbags bursting from age and shell hits, the supporting log beams sagging from initially bad design and worse construction. The fighting positions were badly laid out. They'd been thrown up on top of the barren hill like little forts. Most had terrible fields of fire. Not only could the weapons not reach down to get grazing fire, but one good enemy SP or MG across the valley could slam rounds right into the bunker's firing ports and close them down. It was a wonder they were still there, especially when you looked at the junkyard in front of the position. The wire barrier had been as badly laid out as the fighting line, and as sadly neglected. Along its helter-skelter barbed wire apron were bits and pieces of rat-gnawed enemy dead in bloody khaki. The whole thing was just a broken-down hodgepodge of stakes, concertina wire, and mines thrown up or buried by one generation of defenders after another. I'd seen it all before with the Raiders, but somehow it was different now when I realized I'd have to live there. And of course, there was no doubt the frontline dilapidation had continued most enthusiastically in the months I'd been away. As usual, there were no barrier maps. Where are the mines? Was the logical question. Out there, with a broad sweep of the arm, was the standard reply. I couldn't understand it. The positions had been there 1 year. They'd been occupied by elements of 4 different divisions, and it seemed as though not a damn thing had been done to improve them. They were death traps, nothing more or less. Who's kidding whom, I wondered, as I headed back to Fox the next morning. The fighters knew the truth, but maybe the generals really believed the story they fed the politicians, that the 8th Army defense was an impregnable line in depth. But depth meant good defensive positions behind the main line that were or could be occupied by soldiers in a snap. Our depth was snack bars, volleyball courts, and the regimental Greek theater. Those perfect green sandbag seats belonged on the line. It was criminal. The only depth we had was out front, 2 fortified half-squatted OPs, one astride each major avenue of approach, and both death traps I'd already decided to change, LPs and patrols. But they were not depth. Their function was security, to delay the enemy and provide early warning, and to deceive the enemy as to where the defense was. Yet the latter was hardly possible given the big forts we had sitting astride the trench line like Humpty Dumpty on a wall. Well, I thought, Humpty Dumpty's going to have his great fall if we don't get it together in a big hurry. That night, Fox did a slow walk-through rehearsal of the night relief. Patience had never been one of my strong points, and I saw it slipping now, The rehearsal was by no means a disaster, but it was painfully clear that my boys could barely go through the motions. God only knew what they'd done in training, but they were not ready for the big game. I realized then it was going to be a question of just getting them on the hill. The front line was no place to train, but there was no alternative. I had fledgling architects when what we needed were gnarled old carpenters. I just prayed we'd have time to forge a fighting team before the enemy blew our house down. After the rehearsal, I met with the leaders and issued my order. Simplicity was the word. We would follow the book. Company assembly point to platoon assembly points to squad release points to filling in the line next to Joe Love's fine soldiers. As each Fox platoon leader took over, Joe's relieved force would reverse the procedure and finally they would slip off the hill. The troops were so green I wondered whether we should lock and load. I finally decided that the weapons would be loaded but with no rounds in the chambers, and there'd be no firing without an officer's approval. We got the troops into the sack early and let them sleep in the next morning. There wouldn't be much rest in the next 48 hours, and they'd need all the energy they could muster. I snuck my mess truck forward by day infiltration. This wasn't allowed, a security risk, went the reasoning, but the way my selectively insubordinate mind saw it was, first, I knew how good hot food would taste to the boys in the assembly area before the swap, and second, whoever heard of a mess truck leading a relief anyway? After the company had placed luminescent tape on the backs of their helmets, tightened their gear to make it noise-proof, and blackened their faces a la Raiders, I gave them a little pep talk. Fox Company was dead, I told them. From this moment forward, we were Fighter. We would answer the phone with Fighter Company. We would call ourselves by the new name and use it loud and proud enough that no other unit in our vicinity could be mistaken about what we really were. I saw a lot of smiles. The troops got a charge out of it, at least the ones who could understand me. It was during the rehearsal that I'd realized many of them didn't speak English. Puerto Ricans and Koreans were sprinkled liberally throughout the unit. Between them and the Guamanians, I'd lost track of who the all-American troops really were. It was a problem. The policy of requiring units to be integrated down to the squad was as unworkable now as it had been when first implemented in late 51. In a firefight, there's no margin for misinterpretation, no time to gesture and stumble through pidgin English instructions to get the word across. Yet with up to four languages spoken among any group of 10 soldiers, we had many towers of Babel every 100 yards across the U.S. front. But at least the men of F Company had one thing in common. They were all fighters now, and with heads held a little higher, we saddled up and started on our way. It was Halloween night, and quiet, less the routine hammering of H and I fire. Along with my advance party, Joe Love had his guides at all critical points of the relief route. It was still his ball game. I slipped through a sandbagged tunnel near the edge of the road and waited in his CP. The large bunker was split in two with a long interior wall. Half was the company switchboard and commo center. The other half was the CP itself, with a couple of painfully uncomfortable sacks of interwoven commo wire for the CO and top kick. It was a good setup. The only thing I'd change would be the beds. I had a chance to watch Joe in action. He was calm, cool, and professional. His third platoon leader was one Master Sergeant Bob Fowler, whom I'd known in the Wolfhounds and who could only be described as Huckleberry Finn in fatigues, sandy hair, freckles, a mischievous smile. I asked Joe if Fowler could stay with us a few days. Joe went along with it when he realized we were old pals. This led to an agreement in which, in addition, Love would leave a good NCO with each platoon, plus someone from his FO party to gently introduce my green unit to the place. Neither of us told our next higher-ups. They'd have said no, just as we didn't tell them I was keeping G Company's machine guns. I wanted the firepower on the hill zeroed in and ready to go, leaving mine at the bottom of the hill for Joe's boys to pick up on the way down. I promised Joe he'd get no dogs among fighters' equipment. The bottom line here was trust, and in that regard, the two of us were from the same school. In Joe's words, years later, we trusted. The scheme worked. and so did the relief. At dawn, I finally had the numbers and assumed command. Joe wished me luck and moved out with his CP group. A few days later, his transition team was gone, too. What a good man, I thought, as Sergeant Bob Fowler slipped off the hill. Little did I know that 16 years later, his fine soldiering and leadership would lead to his death. Just before he was to be promoted to Sergeant Major in a battalion of the 1st of the 5th Cav, he'd be killed walking point as a company first sergeant in a bad battle in another no-win war, which, like Korea, would gut the army of its very fiber, its NCOs. The 40th Division was deployed on the east coast, near a large valley called the Punch Bowl. The right flank of the division was on the Punch Bowl's northern rim, linking up with other units to form a human wall stretching from coast to coast. Fighter Company's defensive sector started on a high hill where we tied in with easy. We had the top. A ridgeline sweeping up from the valley floor on this eastern edge of our position was a company-sized enemy avenue of approach right into my 3rd platoon. The sector ran downhill into a draw, then up another hill to our west about 100 yards where we tied in with George Company. The draw led into the valley, widening as it went, and by the time it hit the valley floor, it was wide enough to take almost 2 enemy battalions abreast. Called the Gap, it was a most dangerous regimental avenue of approach, and it didn't take much to see, and it was recognized the whole way from Army to Corps to Division, Regiment, Battalion, and especially to me, that fighter held the critical ground. To overrun the Punch Bowl, the enemy would have to strike through my position. If they secured the High Knob, my left flank, it would be smooth sailing, walking, or rolling. The draw was also a good tank avenue of approach. From there, right through the Gap to the flatlands behind. It was not a great place for a green regiment. My tasks were many, and competed in priority. Holding the hill and keeping the boys alive were the key governing factors. Patrols had to go out and the men had to be trained, but keeping them alive also meant an immediate rebuild of the breastworks and the solving of a serious field sanitation problem. Rats fed off the enemy dead on the wire, as well as on any food they found on position, and infested every bunker. Some were as long as an arm. I worried about hemorrhagic fever, a killer disease, the first sign of which was the whites of the eyes going red with blood, like someone had given them a good poke. I remembered Uncle Roy telling me about the big influenza epidemic that roared through Europe in 1918. More people died at the end of World War I from the flu than were knocked off by shot. But as far as I was concerned in the Somme-like Korean trenches of 1952, one was no worse than the other, be it a slug or a bug that got him. I'd still be losing a valuable soldier. The bunkers were death traps, not just because of their high profiles, but because they were too heavily built, easily 20,000 sandbags to many of them. The men piled the sandbags on like the Crusaders had piled on armor, but the sandbags weakened the heavy wooden timbers, and just like the Crusaders, who became so heavily protected they couldn't even stand up to face the enemy, soldiers across the front were being crushed to death or mangled when a direct hit or heavy rain caused their sandbagged bunkers to collapse on top of them. Joe Rice did justice to his West Point military engineering degree by designing a sleek, low-profile fighting bunker. We figured each platoon could manage one rebuild per night, the troops filling sandbags in chow bunkers on the reverse slope, unobserved by the enemy, by day. So come nightfall, the bunker building would be a simple assembly job, with all materials pre-stocked. At the same time, the OP in front of 3rd Platoon would be relocated and rebuilt, while the one at the Gap would be abandoned and booby-trapped. I decided to replace this one with the 2-man roving OP whose members could provide early warning and hightail it home. I ordered rat poison by the ton and no care package food on the hill. I abolished the practice of throwing empty sea ration cans, a rodent delicacy, in front of the trench, and had the enemy dead burned off the wire with napalm. The wire itself would be upgraded when the weather changed. We'd have a slightly better chance of working through the uncharted AP mines without blowing ourselves up when the ground was frozen hard, and whenever all this was completed, we'd rebuild the reverse slope bunkers. I woke up on 4 November 1952 thinking that a year had passed since that terrible night on Hill 400. What had it been for, I wondered. The month of November 52 saw the heaviest fighting of the past year, with U.S. casualties up to 1,000 a week. The peace talks dragged on and on, while troopers on the ground still sat on death row waiting for a reprieve that never came. More firepower, air and arty, had now officially been used in Korea than in all of World War II. Fighter was catching hundreds of incoming rounds a day, mostly 82mm and 120mm mortars and 45mm and 75mm pack howitzers. The thing that always got to me was that while pound for pound we had the enemy incredibly outgunned, they had none of the good stuff we had, no tactical barbed wire or minefields or tac air. It didn't stop them from nickel and diming us, literally around the clock. Their artillery was burrowed, corkscrew fashion, into the hillside, sometimes on tracks. The guns would be pulled up along the track to their firing positions, poop out a few rounds, and then be slid back. Like the Chinese, the North Koreans needed a lot of pre-planning to concentrate heavy fire in support of a specific operation, and lousy commo made them inflexible once the show got on the road. Still, we'd been online less than a week, and had taken a couple of WIA every day, mostly from direct artillery hits that ripped into the bunkers. Joe Rice had an 82mm round slammed through three layers of sandbags and split the 14-inch logs on the roof right over his head as he lay dozing in his bunker one afternoon. Luckily, it didn't go off. A lot of dirt, but no problem, he said. About 20% of all incoming, much of it old Soviet ammo, were duds. But tell that to your heart as you sat listening to the whine, the whistle, and the crunch. About one round's worth every 3 minutes across the company front. Fortunately, U.S. artillery was responsive, accurate, and plentiful during this period. The emphasis on it, pretty well a whole new ball game compared to my last tour, was, I figured, based on Napoleon's concept of depending on firepower when the infantry was weak. God knows we were piss weak, so the arty, historically the doe-foot's best friend, was ours too in this old-style trench war. By the 8th day online, I was exhausted. I hadn't clocked too many hours of sleep since we arrived. Little did I know it would be that way the whole time we were in this sector, which came to be known simply as the Gap. There was always something to fix or rebuild, always someone to train. It amazed me how much there was to do. At platoon level, I'd somehow come to assume that on a day-to-day level, we were the ones doing the work, while the company commander just sat back and took it easy until the operation warning order came. How very wrong I'd been. The respect I'd had for Michaely, Gilchrist, and Evans only grew as I came to appreciate the heavy responsibility and the great demands of a job they'd performed so well. Still, the work in Fighter was worth the effort. Our position and our people were looking better and better. We were becoming a company in spirit and proficiency, as well as in fact. The patrols were already meeting with some success. In the first week, men of Fighter killed half a dozen North Koreans with no casualties of our own. Our first enemy probe, which occurred near where the 3rd Platoon OP was being built, was also nipped in the bud, despite the fact that the North Koreans were at their finest at probes, with specially trained sappers for whom patience was a strong point. The sappers would crawl along on their bellies, snipping their way, with cloth between their cutters' teeth, which muffled the metallic click, through minefields laced with booby traps, flares, and barbed wire entanglements, and be in your position without you hearing one sound. But Joe Stokes, platoon leader of the 3rd, had wisely placed an outguard on a knob 100 yards from the OP to provide the work detail with security, and a squad of North Koreans walked right into them. It was total surprise all round, but the final result was no friendly casualties and 3 more enemy KIA. Little kills like these did wonders for morale, and even more important, they dispelled the rumors that the North Koreans were 10-foot-tall monsters roving through the valley like slanty-eyed Frankensteins. I spent many daylight hours in my observation post OP studying the battlefield. Joe Love had rebuilt this critical facility. It was a first-class command center that allowed a good view of the entire company front plus a clear view of No Name Hill, the grim enemy-held fortress dominating our immediate battle area. This was my battle station. In it, I worked out fighters' flash fires, complete defense barrages of mixed artillery, mortars, and flares, prearranged and codenamed with my artillery FO. From it, I would initially control my unit during an enemy attack. At night, I worried my fledgling patrols through their paces as if they were my sons out with the family car for the first time. I'd gone on a few patrols myself to help the boys through their opening night jitters, but as the company CEO, I really had no business being out there in no man's land, and with great reluctance, I now remained in the trenches and lent moral support. The self-exile had certain advantages, though. If nothing big was happening, like a patrol getting lost, which in the early days happened with painful regularity, I'd walk the front line from end to end a couple of times. I'd check each position, talk to the troops until I got to know their names and could recognize their voices in the dark, and give quiet, impromptu classes.